Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me today is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hello, Teresa. Thank you.
Good to be here, and exciting topic today, actually, I think. Rerum Novarum is our subject matter today.
It sort of culminates what we've been talking about, especially in the last program, and it sort of sets us up then because it really is a groundbreaker for much of the social justice teachings of the church in the 20th century.
And the church inspired most of the work that happened in that area, I believe. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, very much so. You know, heavily inspired it. And certainly here in the United States, that's a whole other question itself. You know.
I think something that's often forgotten is how much the church has done for society.
I think, you know, along with that, too, is that the fact that Western civilization basically ignored that encyclical, much to its own peril, and the experience that we had in the 20th century with communism, with the Cold War, fascism, you know, it was a terrible century when you think about it, and much of it is due to the fact that we had not listened to the wisdom of Leo XIII. So it's got some good stuff in it.
Right.
So. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and we'll just jump right in.
Okay.
We're talking about economic issues, and at first blush you'd say, well, what does the church have to say about that, or what is the church to do about that? Remember that Adam Smith had already analyzed the economic workings reality and came to the conclusion that in his masterpiece in 1776, The Wealth of Nations, came to the conclusion that the best thing that a society can do to spur on the economy is nothing at all. It's best to step back and let entrepreneurial leadership take over, that people will, and we've seen this already, that they will organize in such a way as to be as efficient as possible, and that with that, you'll have an increase. The pie actually grows. This is really a new idea. Prior to this, mercantilism basically argued that there was a static pie, and if you wanted to increase your size, your piece of pie, you had to take it from somebody else. Smith proves that that isn't true, that in fact the pie can grow if you do the right things, and entrepreneurs naturally will do the right thing. So he's very optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Following after Adam Smith is another English observer. His name is Thomas Malthus, and he comes to the conclusion that sounds very good. He's a very pessimistic fellow. He comes to the conclusion that while that sounds very good and there is an increase in prosperity, in general wealth, that the population will outgrow the general wealth. He argues that population grows by leaps and bounds, whereas the general wealth of nations will grow arithmetically, step by step, and so his argument is that the population will outpace the food and the other things that are necessary for life, and that will lead to famine, wars, death, pestilence, which will winnow away much of the population, and it starts over again. So he's very pessimistic. He sees life as being very brutish.
Okay.
You know, well, following after him is yet another philosopher, another Englishman by the name of David Ricardo, and Ricardo is as optimistic as Malthus is pessimistic.
Okay.
But at the same time, his big contribution really to a sense is looking at what he divides the economy into three basic groups. And then he analyzes what they're each going after, and the one group he sees as being labor.
Okay.
This is a group. Now Karl Marx will take that same idea and turn it into a class,
mm-hmm.
and of course he'll popularize class struggle. But we ought to keep this in mind because these are the categories we work out of even to today. First you have labor, then you have capital. Capitalists,
mm-hmm.
and then you have landed people, the people who own land, buildings, things of that nature. We usually lump them into capitalists also, but there is a distinction. Ricardo points out the distinction is that the capitalist is, his bailiwick is money, is raw wealth, and the landed, the people who own land, their bailiwick is a thing. It might be a factory, or it might be an office building, or it might be land itself, you know, but it's a tangible. And he says that each of the three are after something quite different. And there, he says that you do find there now a limited pie. And the increase of one means the decrease of the other. And so that means that when labor, what labor is after is wages, an increase in wages. And they're always in favor of an increase in wages. It's only in extraordinary circumstances that you'll have labor turning around to ownership and saying, oh, cut our wages. It has happened on a few occasions, mainly because a business is about to go out of business, and just to preserve their jobs, they're willing to do that. But that's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Labor wants to increase wages. They want some other things too, but that's number one. At the same time, capitalists want to increase profits. Now, you increase profits, there are several ways of doing that, but one way is to decrease labor. So they're in juxtaposition, one against the other. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third element, and that is those who own land, the land owners, they want the rents. Mm-hmm. Now, if they increase the rents, that lowers the profits. If it lowers the profits, then the capitalists don't like that, but then the laborers don't like that either, because that means that there's a stronger argument for lower wages. Mm-hmm. So you see how all of these are tied together?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now Adam Smith, Thomas Malthus, David Ricardo are all looking at this from a rather theoretical point of view. Karl Marx turns this into reality. You know, he's looking at class struggle. And he's seeing a dialectic at work here, which we've spoke about last time around. And that dialectic can be quite, when it's played out, the bringing about of the synthesis can be quite violent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they recognize that. Well, while these guys are thinking about this, and later on we're going to talk about the Oxford movement and basically the state of the Anglican Church. That's one thing, and we'll take a look at that later. But the state of the Catholic Church is very much engaged in these questions. Now, it depends on the area and depends on the nation. Not so much in France. Most Catholic thinking in France is frozen in the two-nation of France argument. So they're not able to get out of that box. And most of them in France and even in Belgium are pretty much held in suspended animation that came about with Gregory the 16th Mirare Vos. Remember, he condemns liberalism. And so they're kind of frozen in that. If you go over to Germany, you find something quite different going on. They sort of looked, and when they read Mirare Vos, they said, oh, he's talking to the French, and that he's not talking to us. And so you have people in Germany, like, for instance, Bishop Kettler of Mainz, who is very much engaged in the social questions of labor and of the condition of the urban poor. And then also Father Kolpling was engaged in this too. Kolpling societies are all over the United States. They were brought over by German Catholics, but certainly throughout Germany. And these are societies that are set up in such a way as to be mutual aid societies for laborers, for the common people. So, you know, and they're cooperating. Bishop Kettler and Father Kolpling and many others in Germany are cooperating both with the government and with Lutherans in addressing these issues of the plight of the laborers, you know, what Marx referred to as the proletariat, which we had looked at last time around. And one of the vehicles for this is a Catholic political party called the Center Party. It would be, I don't want to draw an analogy too close, but it would be like taking the Missouri Catholic Conference and forming a political party around the issues of the Missouri Catholic Conference. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We use the Missouri Catholic Conference here in the state of Missouri, and certainly other states do the same thing, to bring together the efforts of each of the dioceses within this metropolitan in order to lobby for issues that have a particular Catholic bent to it. And, of course, Democrats and Republicans go crazy with us because we're allied on some issues and not on other issues, you know. In Germany, if you can imagine a political party set up like that, and, in fact, it was one of the most important parties. Germany has several political parties. Even to this day, the second largest political party in Germany is called the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union. That is an outgrowth of the center party.
Hmm.
And from time to time, it's in power. Right now, the SPD is in power. The Social Democratic Party is in power. But from time to time, it comes back. And this is a vehicle that the church uses in Germany toward the fulfillment of issues of particularly Catholic concerns in German society. Like what? Well, for one thing, they press very hard toward the government accepting the responsibility of going into factories with inspectors and checking safety conditions of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
There were very few, as you can well imagine. They simply weren't paying attention, and many people were being injured permanently. And of course, they were. You know, if you were a proletarian and you were injured severely and couldn't work, you're out of luck.
Your family is, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's one thing that they pressed for. They pressed for this concept of a minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
That's something.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking the 1870s and 1880s.
Right.
1880s, you know. The hours of labor, limiting the number of hours that a laborer has to work. And then also legislation that would limit child labor and women's labor, so that women who are working would work under more humane conditions and children wouldn't work at all. Now, the other side of that is that would mean compulsory school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, England actually introduced that before Germany, of compulsory schools, and the idea there was to get these kids away from the factories and give them something else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And basically schooling. Here in America, we had a very strong move also toward early education. The reason for that was that our founding fathers believed that the best way to have a democracy is to have an intelligent electorate, you know. So that's moving too. They even went further and argued that that the government should accept a certain responsibility for workers, for people, for citizens, when they reached a golden age. You know, you get to be so old and you can't work anymore, and so it's time for you to retire. And most people don't save, or didn't save, toward that retirement. And they just, after their retirement, or after they had to stop working, they fell into a terrible poverty unless their families took care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they suggested, and center party pushed very hard in Germany towards something that came to be known as social security. Yeah. Pensions, even cooperative stores. You know, these are all ideas coming from Bishop Kettler and from Father Koepling and from many other religious leaders within Germany. They found at the time a very receptive chancellor, Otto von Bismarck,
wow,
who's known, of course, more for his war making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got three quickie little wars, the Danish War, the Austrian War, and then, of course, the Franco-Prussian War. He pulls those off all within about 6 years. They're all quickie little wars. Even the Franco-Prussian War wouldn't have lasted very long if it wasn't for the Paris holding out as long as it did. And but actually the bulk of his life, if you look at the life of Otto von Bismarck, the bulk of his life was constructing alliances for peace. He believed in the balance of power and to try to bring about a Europe that would be balanced in such a way that no one would go to war.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? He succeeded. World War One only happened after they dismantled his alliance system.
Interesting.
The other thing he was actually known for also was introducing these humane social elements within the German government. And there are a lot of arguments as to why he did that. And the cynical argument is that he was trying to keep, by giving labor something, he was trying to keep labor from getting, asking for too much. And so he succeeds in avoiding the kind of revolutions that you have, certainly in Russia in 1917, and then the turmoils that you have in France every so many years. And in a cynical way, he succeeds in doing that. But he also creates really the first modern industrialized social state, and in doing that, he's able to bring about some kind of a settlement within society that it was reasonable for everybody. Well, all of this strikes at laissez-faire practices, obviously. And German industrialists and German capitalists were not happy with all of this, but they found themselves basically having to deal with a government that was going to force this about and bring together capital and labor and government, the three of them, into the negotiating table together. It might be one of the reasons why, even to this day, there are strikes in Germany are very rare. They do happen, but they tend to be pretty rare. And workers in Germany are very pampered. They're also extremely productive, which is another point, too.
No, really.
But their work week is far shorter than ours. Their vacation time is far longer than ours. They have lots of wonderful little perks, and they get away with it mainly because they're so productive.
Mm-hmm.
Take that for what it's worth. But the fact of the matter is that with the coming of Leo XIII, this movement in Germany got a real ally. In fact, even before he was elected Pope, when he was serving as papal nuncio to Belgium, as Vincent Joachim Pacy, he was a very strong advocate for labor in Brussels. He saw firsthand. Brussels was a very heavy industrial city, lots of poverty. Typical proletariat, textile industry, lots of proletariat. And he rebuked on several occasions the Belgian clergy and even the Belgian hierarchy for not having been engaged and involved in the plight of the poor. Which is interesting because earlier on in 1830, they had had an alliance between the Catholic hierarchy and the liberals in Belgium in order to bring about the independence of Belgium. If you remember, in 1830, there was the revolution that broke Belgium off from the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
But they did that specifically for really sectarian purposes so that they could have a Catholic country. Now they had a Catholic country, an industrialized Catholic country, and as far as Cardinal Pacy was concerned, they weren't doing anything with it. And this particularly came true in 1886 in the industrial city of Charleroi. There was a tremendous strike there, and it was an ugly scene. And in the end, the church in Charleroi sided with the laborers and helped to move toward more humane changes in the living conditions and working conditions of the people there. So here we're going to see this man who's going to be elected Pope in just a couple years, and he's already heavily engaged in these efforts. And as you can see, it pays off while he was Pope in the way the Belgian hierarchy addressed the issues at the strike at Charleroi. In England, the same thing is underway, similar positions. Cardinal Manning of Westminster is very interested, very concerned for the plight of the urban masses. And in fact, more than once he was called a socialist by his opponents. But when some terrible strikes took place in London, the dock strikes took place in London, it was the British government who turned to Cardinal Manning, a very old man at this time, and had him act as the negotiator between the two sides. He arbitrated the strike. They didn't turn to the the Archbishop of Canterbury. They turned to Manning instead, who's a very interesting fellow. We'll see him a little bit later on. He's sort of like the fruits of the Oxford movement. Mm-hmm. Manning himself converts to Catholicism, and then ultimately ends up becoming the Cardinal of Westminster. While this is happening in Germany, Belgium, England, in the United States too, we could talk a lot about the engagement of Catholic clergy and especially the hierarchy in labor issues in the United States. In Latin countries, there were different circumstances, and there was not that progression. Particularly in Spain, you have a very close tie between the clergy and the hierarchy and the extreme right, the monarchy, and they pretty much worked lockstep. That's going to continue on even into the 20th century in the form of mutual support between Francisco Franco and his fascist government and the hierarchy in Spain. What's happened since then has been a beautiful transition with the death of Franco and the restoration of the monarchy, a constitutional monarchy, and Spain has just blossomed beautifully in the latter 20th century, and the church has moved along nicely with it. The same thing is also true, of course, of the Latin American countries dominated by Spanish bishops. That's another story for another day, though. In Italy, it's very interesting, too, because when Leo XIII became pope, he found himself having to change the church's position vis-a-vis the government from Pius IX. Now, we left off with Pius IX sitting in the Vatican, a prisoner of the Vatican, self-imposed, but on the other hand, the Italian government had not been particularly nice to him, kind to him, yeah. And for the last years of his life, he was very explicit in keeping devout Catholics, practicing Catholics out of the government. So even as Italy then formed together this united country with Rome as its capital and with the entire country united under this constitutional monarchy, devout Catholics in one of the most Catholic countries in the world were not able to participate in government. So this just basically turned the government over to secularists.
Right.
And Leo saw this, and Leo did not want this to continue on. He believed that the Catholic population should engage with government, should be involved in government. He can look up to Germany and see what's happening there. He can look over to England. He can look at Belgium, and he sees that it can work. We'll see later on that he engages France in order to move the French Catholics out of their enclosed position also. And in Italy, he's got a real problem because the vast majority of devout, sincere Catholics have been following the Pope and ignoring the government. And now he's trying to find a way to get them back engaged with the government. He's got basically two groups that he has to deal with. And one of those are called the intransigents.
Okay.
Which are just as their name is. They won't have any compromise with the kingdom at all. They want nothing to do with the kingdom of Italy. And it's going to be hard to move those people. And then he finds the other smaller group who has been following Pius IX, but they're actually transigents. They would like to cooperate with the government, and now they've got a pope that's encouraging them to do that.
Okay.
He has a lot of problems moving the church in that direction in Italy, but one of the things he does is he begins to organize what he calls labor pilgrimages, and he encourages workers throughout Italy to come to Rome for a pilgrimage.
Okay.
And there he would speak to them and encourage them in their labor, to recognize their labor as being a good thing.
Okay.
And now... It's a wonderful move moving the hearts and minds of the masses who had been left, when you think about this, had basically been left with socialism and communism as their only source of encouragement. And now you find a pope who is encouraging them also. And so it's beginning to undercut the communists and socialists in Italy. It also causes him to do looking seriously at the issues of the people and looking for the labor social question and its need for some solution. So really, very early on in 1882, he has commissioned a blue ribbon study group. It's called the Roman Committee of Social Justice. And he brings in leading theologians and sociologists and economists and other Catholic thinkers onto this commission. And he gives them this mandate. And I'm going to quote the mandate. It says this: to study deeply and thoroughly from a Catholic point of view the social and economic questions of labor, to establish principles based on that study, and to secure acceptance of these principles as the basis for action. So he wants to study the issue of social and economic questions of labor, and he wants them to do this by using Catholic theology, Catholic principles, and then having done that, to put it into action. So he's got a pretty good plan there, you know. And so they do that. And they take a long time. You know, it's not until 1891 that the encyclical is actually promulgated. So it's going to be 11 years. But anyway, I guess I could make some sort of a comment about the intensity of work in the Roman, but I better not. Anyway, in 1890, there was
in Rome in the summer.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. You know. Well,
cold in the winter, right?
Cold in the winter, yeah. In 1890, there is a labor conference that is called in Berlin. The young emperor of the Second Empire, the German Empire, is Wilhelm II. Now, once again, he's mainly known in the English-speaking world as the cause of World War I, which is up in the air. He really didn't cause World War I, but then on the other end, he didn't do anything to prevent it. But that's what he's best known for. But in actuality, he did a lot before that. And one of the things he did before that was he really implemented much of the work and vision of Otto von Bismarck, who, by the way, he fired for other reasons. But in 1890, he called a labor conference in Berlin and had labor representatives there. Now, this is quite unique. You know, think about this. When was the first time anything like that happened in the United States? I would probably think, with the possible exception of a couple visits to the White House with Theodore Roosevelt, it was probably really Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the Great Depression where labor is actually engaged in this country. But here he is in 1890 engaging labor. And he also, there's correspondence between the Emperor of Germany, Wilhelm II, and Pope Leo XIII as they went back and forth sharing ideas. So by this time, by 1890, the commission is just about ready to present some findings to the Pope. At the same time, there is this this meeting that's going on, and with Leo XIII encouraging the Emperor of Germany to move towards some of these social questions using what later will be Rerum Novarum, you know. And in fact, there is legislation that is introduced into the German Parliament, the Reichstag, that is based on this. So in 1891, then, the encyclical is promulgated. The full title of it is De Conditione Opificium Rerum Novarum, but it's just known as Rerum Novarum. And it has three parts to it. It is readily available. You can go over to the Daughters of St. Paul and pick up a copy for around 65 cents. a nice bound copy, or you can probably get it off the internet too. Uh-huh. It's all over. But there are three major sections to it. And the first section is a rejection of the socialist answers. You know, the socialists have their answer for solving the social and economic problems of the proletariat, the urban poor. And their idea, basically, of course, is to take away property, is to deny property itself. And as I had that long quote last week from Karl Marx, where he basically says, okay, you guys, meaning the capitalists, have impoverished mm-hmm. us guys, the proletariat. Now we're going to impoverish you so that we'll all be poor.
Right.
You know, that's not at all what Leo is saying. And what he's saying instead is that people have the right to a living wage, and they have the right to convert those wages into property themselves. He speaks of this as the inviolability of private property. So, remember we described that proletariat who got up in the morning in a rent-to-own bed and mm-hmm. in an apartment that wasn't his, and all the other things that went throughout the day, and then we find him at the end of the day climbing back into that bed, and nothing that he's touched all day long is his. Now, what Leo is saying is in that first section that man should be paid the wages that are necessary for him to not just survive, but to prosper.
Mm-hmm.
And that fellow has the right to buy property and own property, and that should not be taken away from him, so that ultimately down the line he should be able to, you know, have his own little bungalow and own his own little piece of bonanza land and you know, have a car and, you know, live in St. Charles County.
Mm-hmm.
He has a right to do that. And that should not be taken away from him. The second section of the encyclical recommends that the church in general, and certainly Christian groups, bring about a dialogue on social issues. And that in doing that, that you would gather together people who are both capitalists and laborers together and look at the issues, specific issues, and work out solutions. This is a rejection of class hostility. This is a rejection of class mm-hmm. warfare.
That's something we could work on, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, it comes up all the time.
It does keep coming back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, as much as he's turning to, and this is another side of this critique that Karl Marx has. You know, remember we talked about the opium of the masses mm-hmm. being religion and all that. He obviously, I think he was dead by the time Rerum Novarum was published anyway, but he obviously didn't understand the Catholic position on this, because not only does the Pope recommend that labor cool it and talk out their issues, he also reminds the wealthy that they have a social obligation. They have a Christian social obligation to assist the poor. You know, it's very St. Vincent de Paul.
That's what I was just thinking, going back to what we talked about.
Yeah. And that's embodied in that encyclical. Mm-hmm. As I say, I really recommend it to everybody. It's an easy read. Some encyclicals are not easy to read. This one is an easy one to read, and it's got great insights
mm-hmm.
in it. The third section dealt with some rather specific laissez-faire abuses and the need to protect workers from what he called, quote, the cruelty of men of greed, unquote. So he recognizes that the world is full of these wolves, mm-hmm. and he's arguing that there are specific ways that people need to go about, labor needs to go about to protect itself from the cruelty of men of greed. And how do you do that? And here's the first time that you're going to have a pontiff actually advocate this, and that is to organize labor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only by organizing that that you're able then to protect yourself and, as a result, get the kind of living wages that are needed in order to live a dignified life for you and for your family. This is a landmark. Now, one of the things, too, that's important in this, because a lot of, unfortunately, and I've seen this happen, there are people who will pull out their copy of Rerum Novarum, and they'll pull out a phrase or one sentence, and then they'll put that on a bumper sticker or something, and then beat the church over the head with that. But I want to make a little fine point here, and that's this. Leo argues in Rerum Novarum that people have the right to a living wage, a wage that is one of dignity. They have the right to negotiate that wage, and therefore they have the right to share in the profits of that enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I say that again, to share in the profits of that enterprise. He is assuming that we're talking about an enterprise that is established to make money, whether it be a factory producing automobiles or a telephone company or an internet service or, you know, whatever.
Right.
The object behind the company, the reason why the company is established, is to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And the people then deserve, those workers deserve a portion of that profit.
That they helped make.
That they helped make, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where he's going. Now, what happens is when you take and you take a phrase, and not the whole sentence, what you end up with is a club that people have used to pound over the head of the church, basically saying, you preach this, but you don't live it out yourself. I mean, look at your own workers. And I think that we are very much aware that there is a responsibility for those who work directly as a career, work for the Catholic Church, to have wages that are set up similar to what Leo XIII is talking about, wages that are dignified and that take care of the needs of the person, all of the other social needs, the health and life and all of that, retirement and everything. But the understanding always has to be that it's a question of profits, and I don't know of anything that the church engages in that is set up to turn a profit.
Right.
I think hospitals sometimes turn a profit, but they're not set up to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I have yet to meet a Catholic school that turns a profit. And you know, so when you go to take Rerum Novarum and take it down to the Archbishop and hit him over the mitre with Rerum Novarum, think twice before you do that, or let's read the whole encyclical, because we're not talking about profits here. The money that sustains Catholic education, as well as many other charitable organizations, Catholic Charities and others, is free will donations that come from the people,
mm-hmm.
and also from tuitions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be constantly a balance in that. Anyway, just put that as a little aside, to remember that when you read Rerum Novarum, read the whole thing. And what you have then is really, in this encyclical, a juxtaposition against the Communist Manifesto. You know, it's just, if you read the Communist Manifesto, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, and here, let's go get them. And then read Rerum Novarum. It's a very, very different kind of an approach. It is a condemnation of laissez-faire economic doctrine, the iron law of wages. And he is very clear in calling that the cruelty of men of greed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, it's a rejection of scientific socialism that's portrayed in Karl Marx. He has a couple other, I guess, appendices at the end that are kind of interesting for us to keep in mind. He turns to governments, and he warns governments not to overtax workers. You know, basically he says to them, look, these people have worked very hard to get what they got, the wages. Don't raise their taxes so much as to take it away at the other end.
Wow.
You know? You know, recently,
ding, ding, ding.
Came over, yeah, right. I came across a young man who is in college,
uh-huh.
and he's been doing odd jobs and things like that throughout. But he got a job with a major company right now. It's a big St. Louis firm, and He's been working very, very hard at this company, and he was incredibly shocked when he sat down and he got his first paycheck, because he had figured out how much he made an hour, which was not that terribly much at entry level, and then he multiplied the time, the number of hours that he had worked for those 2 weeks, and he figured out what he got. And when he opened the paycheck, it wasn't nearly as much. Well, why not? Well, you had this tax and that tax and the Social Security and those, one thing after another. That's demoralizing.
It is very.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to jump on the Laffer curve right here and, you know, go goofy on taxes, but this is a point that Leo makes, is that you have to be moderate, that the government has to be moderate in its taxation from the moral position that this is money that these people earned, and they should keep as much of it as possible. Take that for what it's worth. He also argued that labor organizations should be free from employer influence and supervision. This is really insightful. I mean, here's this 19th century pope who is talking about a company union, which I experienced when I was a teenager. I was working at a particular job, and the union that we belonged to was basically formed by the company.
Oh.
And every time we came up for, you know, wage increases, we knew we were just getting rolled, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And he's arguing that you shouldn't allow this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the other thing, the other insight that he had was the role of women. And certainly he's not going to be one of the great saints of feminism, because his argument is that women have a great dignity. They do not belong in those factories, but their dignity is that they are the mothers of humane influence. And the greatest humane influence a woman can have in society is in homes.
Mm-hmm.
And she humanizes her husband. She humanizes her children. She raises them to be humans with human dignity. And so I'm not going to, once again, put words into his mouth that all women need to be at home, but he's saying that the highest office that a woman can hold is that mm-hmm. of a mother. You know, you hear the term. I mean, I heard this way back when I was in high school, that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And there's, you know, that's a good insight that I think he had there.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things he does in Rerum Novarum, and this is often overlooked, is that he abandons the medieval concept that the church had all throughout these centuries of a model of a cooperative society in favor of something different, something new. He had come to the conclusion that the Enlightenment period, the revolutions, the Industrial Revolution, the Urban Revolution, all of these things destroyed the possibility of a cooperative society. You know, it's going back to that three estates kind of a thing, the first estate, second estate, and third estate, each of them performing their particular functions in order to bring about a more humane and a more Christian society. What Leo does instead is he backs away from that, establishes a whole new set of principles upon which a society can move. And so what he does is he's reestablishing a new cooperative society based upon natural rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's drawing heavily off of St. Thomas Aquinas, but he's drawing on natural law and natural rights rather than drawing on the sociology, I guess you could say, or the political science of Thomistic philosophy. Those natural rights include certain basic dignities that people have, including property ownership. Well, we're going to see that in the 20th century, this whole idea, this whole concept is imbued with Catholic social justice teachings. and whether that's going to find itself in 1931 in the publication of Quadragesimo Anno, the 40th year, which is Pius the 11th's great encyclical. And that encyclical has incredible influence all throughout the industrialized world in the establishment of Catholic action groups and Catholic study groups. Here in the here in the United States, the forerunner of the NCCB was the National Catholic Welfare Commission, and Monsignor Ryan, in particular, in dealing with the office, the Secretariat of Social Justice, did an awful lot to get this underway. The study, Quadragesimo Anno, and the principles of that, bringing together labor, management, all kinds of things. Catholic schools are going to be teaching this. They're not going to be teaching the encyclical, but they're going to be teaching the idea of social justice way back in the 30s. You know. 1961, certainly Mater et Magister, that's the encyclical of John the 23rd, one of his two most famous ones, of course, the other being Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth. But Mater et Magister, Mother and Teacher, is speaks also to this idea of social justice based upon the dignity of people. One of my my favorites is Populorum Progressio, and that's an encyclical by Paul VI, again, arguing for the application of sound economic principles based upon the dignity of individuals and of nations, and just had some wonderful things. And then in 1991, celebrating the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, you have John Paul II's own encyclical, The 100th. You know. Well, just as I say, had we paid attention to this encyclical, rather than running off and doing whatever, we could have saved a lot of bloodshed and a lot of hardship in this country, or in this world, in the 20th century. That's about all I really want to say about Rerum Novarum, but I think as we have a little time left, maybe it might be good to get into the mind of Leo the 13th, and what is this guy thinking about in other issues, too, because he's a fascinating pope.
That sounds great.
Okay. And to do that, I guess let's step back a little bit. Let's remember the whole situation in France with the two nations of France, and then let's throw in an American archbishop that stirs the pot. And then from there, we'll see his engagement, first of all, in what he refers to as Americanism, and then his own mind, his own philosophical mind. In 1892, Archbishop John Ireland, his middle name being Controversy, went to France for a visit. And while he was there, he made the statement which just set everybody off. And he said this. He said, "The people is king now."
Okay.
He's known for his controversial topics. Certainly white France went crazy. And, of course, that's most Catholics, devout Catholics in France, that an American bishop would come and make such a statement like that. Well, he then found himself at odds with an Italian bishop who was sent to the United States as the apostolic delegate. His name is Archbishop Francesco Settoli, and Settoli, early on, there are tensions. He recognizes tensions in the United States. There are tensions within the bishops. In the 19th century, there was no national conference. That actually was formed during the First World War. And so each bishop pretty much ran around and did his own thing and said what he wanted to. And so you have these early tensions going on. Ireland, Gibbons, were critical of Settoli. Bishop Spalding even called him a public intruder. It was pretty crazy. At one point, Settoli praised German Catholicism, and that just set all the Irish bishops off. You know? And so while you have all of this tension and people like Ireland saying that there is an American way of doing Catholicism, and if the rest of the world would watch us, you know, they could learn a lot, including the Pope. These things are not going off too terribly well. On top of that, there's a biography that was published in 1897 of Isaac Hecker. Now, Isaac Hecker was a Redemptorist who left the Redemptorists and formed together a new religious order of the Paulist Fathers.
Okay. Okay.
And he did that in 1858. He was a man of action. He was a very progressive, very independent, and very intelligent man. And this biography showed him as being the quintessential American Catholic. And this is what, and Ireland would go along with this, this is what you need to do to be a modern Catholic, is to be progressive and, you know, a man of action and those sorts of things. He would be, from Ireland's point of view, this is the ideal cleric in a democratic society.
Okay.
Well, in France, the other side took up the Hecker thing, with Isaac Hecker being a hero, and they threw that into the faces of the white French. You know, in fact, the book went through 7 publications.
Wow.
In France alone, and the conservatives in France just went absolutely ballistic, and they blamed these Americans for doing all of this, and right around this time, the next year, in 1898, the United States went to war with Spain. Now, you remember the whole thing about the blowing up of the Maine and all of that. Now, Leo XIII tried Vatican diplomacy to avert this war. Not only was Spain a Catholic country, but he was trying to avert an unnecessary war. And the United States seemed to be pretty much hell-bent on fighting this war globally, and of course benefited incredibly from it. The taking of the Philippines, the liberation of Cuba, a number of other little things that came along. But the important thing is, from the Vatican's point of view, is that Leo sent a letter to the bishops of the United States begging them to use all of their influence in the United States. Remember that there were more, the Catholics was the largest body of Christians in the United States,
yeah.
You know, and to do something to move the U.S. government away from war and seek a diplomatic solution. Instead, with the exception of one bishop, Bishop Spalding, instead, all the other bishops rallied around the American flag and were very pro-war.
Wow.
And that was a shock to the Pope that happened. So, 1898, 1899, he came to the conclusion that something had to be done to harness, to rein in this crazy Americanism. And so in 1899, he promulgated an encyclical, Testum Benevolentiae. And what it did was it warned against American ideas. And some of these, and it's known as Americanism.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these ideas are, for instance, the watering down of doctrine in order to convert other people, to attract converts. We wouldn't do anything like that, of course. But these, well,
right,
anyway.
Right.
He warned also of extreme individualism,
mm-hmm.
Especially regarding religion and spirituality. There's always a tendency in American religion to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, mm-hmm. Even in Maryland, the Catholics in colonial Maryland tended to be very private about their Catholicism because they came from England and they felt they had to do that. There was a great quote just a week or two ago from Howard Dean, who's currently running for president on the Democratic ticket, and he had made the comment that he was a prayerful man, that he prayed daily, but he didn't talk about it because he's from New England. You know, that's a very American kind of approach to religion. It's me, you know, it's me and Jesus, and You know, that's individualism within mm-hmm. spirituality and religion. The Pope in this encyclical argues against that, that Catholicism is a very communal religion, not to forget that. An emphasis on action rather than reflection. Well, that's very American. You know, we have a tendency to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he talked about the concern that he had that there were so many variations with or variances with the primitive constitutions of religious orders when they got to the United States. You know, you have a religious order that's established in Europe someplace, and they have a rule. The rule has been accepted. You know, there's an approbation that from the Pope that has established this congregation under this rule. When they get to the United States, the bishops are always tinkering with that in order to, quote unquote, address the American situation. One example that I spent a lot of time on, in fact, my dissertation was on this, was this very same point. Concerning the Brothers of the Christian Schools, Brothers. In their primitive rule, they were not allowed to teach or study Latin or Greek.
That's right.
Jean Baptiste de La Salle had a very good reason for that in the 1600s. When they got to the United States, the bishops wanted to use these educated men to help educate their seminarians. And because there weren't that many Sulpicians running around, that many Vincentians running around, and when they sent them to the Jesuits tended to brain drain the best ones. And certainly here in St. Louis, you had that situation with the seminarians going to St. Louis University. And as I say, the brightest would send letters to the bishop saying, I've decided to become a son of Ignatius of Loyola. And so the bishops wanted to use the brothers in that. So what they did was they got variances on that rule so that they were able to teach Latin and Greek, study it, and then teach it. And this is what the Pope is talking about. You keep on changing these things around. And so this was yet another concern. Now, interestingly enough, there was not a single U.S. bishop that contested this this position. You know, not a single one.
That's pretty good for not supporting his request with the war.
With the war, yeah. But when he was talking about this Americanism, they all sort of recognized, yeah, you got a point there. And what happened then, following after this, is you're going to find that universities, many Catholic universities in the United States, will slowly begin changing their curriculum around to what you would call modern studies. They become known as good schools in engineering, accountancy, medicine, the hard sciences, things of that nature. Theology and philosophy departments take a back position. For one thing, that's a way to attract more students.
Mm-hmm.
And then also you have in seminaries a greater concern for looking at doctrine and particularly at Thomism and accepting that as the way in which you do philosophy and theology in the seminaries. So it has a tremendous impact, at least on in the Catholic realm. It's a sort of a wake-up call. Later on, he has another encyclical, Aeterni Patris, which we may say something about. Actually, it comes earlier in 1879, early in his pontificate, and gives sort of a sense of where he's coming from. And maybe when we're talking about the Oxford movement, we can just sort of tie that in, too.
Okay. Great. It was a great show, Father. That was very interesting.
Thanks.
Always like to look back at Rerum Novarum.
Yeah.
And shall we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
This, of course, is the Feast of St. Blaise that we're doing this program on, and also the Feast of St. Ansgar, who always gets short shrift. And so we just ask the intercession of both of those saints.
Amen. Thank you, Father.